tonight, the last two sessions, we've dealt with seven of the disciples. Last time we were looking at John, the son of Zebedee, Judas Iscariot, and Judas, also known as Thaddeus. Then the second handout, the one this evening, deals with Matthew, Philip, Simon Peter. See all my extra notes. And Simon the Zealot and Thomas. So I don't think we'll end up dealing with all of those tonight, because there is choir practice later on. But we will pick up talking a little bit about Matthew this evening. However, I was actually doing some reading of another book the other day. Picked it up. I've had it for a while, haven't read it, but picked it up. It's called Hope for the Thinking Christian. And was reading along in about the second or third chapter. It's written by Stephen Reese. And ran across a couple of interesting things that I thought, we're talking about disciples. And he was talking about his own journey and being called in various ways. He's actually a psychology professor and a Methodist. But he said, Jesus' words, I will make you fish for something different. That's basically what fishers of men. He called these fishermen and he said, I will make you fish for something different. And then he says, he was challenging them to put their skills to work with a new purpose. He called them from simply making a living into making a life. He went on to talk about the vision that Jesus was sharing with them, although briefly. He had asked the question, why would they leave what they were doing and follow Jesus? He says, a vision should be big enough to allow us room to grow into it. The grace of God calls us out of ourselves into something infinitely bigger. The invisible God calls me to take a spiritual adventure within myself first, before moving out. And then he talks a little bit about his own pilgrimage, and he says, while I've waited to find the perfect job, town, home, and church, all endlessly distracting searches, my life has turned inward. That's the kind of adventure I think the disciples were called to follow Christ, not to a bigger town, a bigger lake, a better synagogue, or a better job, which eventually always show their limits, but to an adventure within their own lives, which in God's hand is always unlimited. The most challenging frontiers lie within our hearts and within our relationships, and that's what draws me in. We're called to something better. We're called to God's very best. And so in thinking about these disciples, but also in thinking about ourselves as disciples, because we are called. A disciple is one that sits at the feet and studies. It's a learner. And we are called to be disciples. Then disciples are also expected to be apostles. Not the title apostle, although a lot of folks try to grab hold of that. But an apostle is someone who is sent out with a message, to tell the message of the one from whom they've been learning and the one who has called them. So we're called to learn and then to tell, and to come back and learn some more and then to tell. Although sometimes I'll tell you more than you want to know, as you all know. But that's what we're all called to do. So what led these individuals to follow Jesus? Reese thinks, and I think he's correct, they were challenged to put their skills to work with a new purpose, from simply making a living into making a life, and to start that spiritual journey within themselves. One of those that was an outcast in many ways, and that we're told gave up a fair amount, although he probably had made a pretty good living. He had socked away some money. He invited Jesus and the disciples to eat with him and his friends, was Matthew, also known as Levi. Was a tax collector of tolls, had a jeans factory. He was also the son of Alphaeus. His call is given in Matthew 9:9, where he is called Matthew. But in Mark 2 and Luke 5, he's called Levi. So we put, those are different traditions, but it's not unusual for somebody to have more than one name, right? If you haven't known anybody, Jim Bob or Billy Bob or Peggy Sue or you know, whatever. You didn't just call them Peggy or Jim. It was Peggy Sue or Jim Bob. So it's not unusual for him to have a different name. If he's the son of Alphaeus, as Mark chapter 2, verse 14 states, then he's the brother of James the Less and Judas, also known as Thaddeus. Now, we've had Peter and Andrew who were brothers. We got James and John who were brothers. And now we potentially have three others who were brothers. So we have said, and I said the first session, that when you look at Andrew, the first thing he did was went and got his brother. And what do we do? What are we called to do? We're really called to start at home. It's not, okay, I make a profession of faith, I get saved, and then I run out and tell the person five blocks over. We tell family first, and especially family that may not know, may not be aware. So it's interesting. They start, and so this is kind of a trying to avoid a sly and a family stone thing here, but it's a family affair, if you know that song. But it was kind of a family affair here. We also know that some were kin to Jesus, and we know that John the Baptizer was his cousin. So it's just, there were many followers, but that inner circle, those 12 that were chosen, some of them were actually related and related to Jesus. And it starts with that family and then moves out. He is from Capernaum. Matthew is from Capernaum. Jesus, some say that Jesus gave him the name Matthew. Others say no, he was Matthew from the tribe of Levi. Others say no, he was Matthew and Jesus gave him the name Levi. But in any instance, we do find him with two different names. He was a tax collector. He served the Romans and Herod Antipas. He not only collected the taxes, but when it came to the customs tolls and tariffs on exported fish, where he generally worked, you would have custom tolls on goods that came in, but also with the fishermen, they would be exporting fish, and he would collect the tariffs and the tolls on those. He was both the tax collector and, in those instances, sometimes the tax assessor, determining what a person would have to pay. Tax collectors were considered traitors by many, considered unclean, not able to go to the synagogue, go to the temple, primarily because they not only worked for the king collecting taxes, but they worked for the Romans. The Romans tended to use indigenous labor. They tended to employ people who were already part of the group that they had conquered to collect their taxes, to do other things like that. Sometimes they would even recruit those that would be more mercenary, to join the Roman soldiers, but they'd always be under the Roman soldiers, the leadership of the Roman soldiers, in order to help maintain the peace. And if somebody said, no, I'm not going to pay my taxes, then they were kind of the police force. They were the tax enforcers. There is nothing said about Matthew's integrity, but most people presume that he was crooked because, quite frankly, back then most of the tax collectors, not tax assessors, most of the tax collectors were crooked. I mean, they got paid by the government to collect the taxes, and anything above the normal rate that they decided they wanted to assess, most of them put it in their own pockets. So they feathered their nests pretty well. I mean, that's a known fact that that many of them would charge above the rate. You know, if Herod says, well, you know, the tax is 5%, and the tax collector comes in and he looks and says, well, everything you've got here and all these animals are in such good shape, you're assessed 8%. If you started arguing, all he had to do was threaten to go over and get some of the local garrison of troops. Not that they were named garrison, but the garrison of troops, and bring them around, they'd take it from you. So you pay it while that other 3% went in his pocket or his bank account. So it was over and above what he was being paid. He was considered outside the law. That is, not the law. He was considered outside the Hebrew law, the law of Moses, as such, and was considered ritually and religiously unclean. And yet, once again, we find Jesus going to and calling people, not the ones that were the nice, squeaky, clean, acceptable folks, but the folks that others excluded. the folks that others excluded. Yet Jesus called. His challenge was to the religious leaders to change and to recognize not only God's grace that had come in him, but also recognize God's grace on these other people. But he also called predominantly the ones who felt ostracized, the ones who were new to the neighborhood, or everybody knew all the warts, all the stories. And Matthew, in Luke chapter 5:28, we're told he leaves everything. In fact, Luke 5:28 indicates that Matthew simply got up from the table and left the money sitting there and left his tax roll sitting there and started walking away. Don't know that he did quite that, because he'd be in a lot of trouble if he left the money in his tax book. But he probably went back and resigned his position as a tax collector, taking everything back to where it belonged, and resigned. And that call is followed by a meal, very possibly at his home. Jesus goes and he eats with Matthew and with other tax collectors. So if it was Matthew's house, he was fairly well off. The church father Clement said that Matthew, a little interesting thing here, I don't know that, there'd be more meat for me, that Matthew was a vegetarian. How he got that, I don't know. Just a little odd thing. I told you this is going to be not stuff we definitely know, but odd legends too. But Clement, one of the early church fathers, wrote about this. It said that actually when Jesus went and ate at Matthew's home, he wasn't eating meat because Matthew was a vegetarian. He served vegetarian meals. I guess a vegetarian alternative. Vegetarian burgers. Or whatever. Tradition states that he authored the Gospel of Matthew in Hebrew. The only persons who say that are Papias, who was a bishop in Asia Minor. In fact, Papias was one of the first ones to talk about Matthew authoring the Gospel, and also Mark. The first evidence we have that John Mark was the author of the Gospel of Mark actually comes from Papias, the early church father and bishop in Asia Minor. Eusebius, but Eusebius said that the Hebrew dialect referred to the distinctively Jewish structure, not spoken Hebrew, but written Hebrew. And biblical Hebrew is different from spoken Hebrew and from medieval Hebrew. And if you think that you could learn biblical Hebrew and then go over to Israel today and go down the street and talk to the people in the marketplace, you might as well be speaking something other than Hebrew, because biblical Hebrew is not the language of the street. Just like even today, in Greek, you had Attic Greek, which was the highbrow. It was the scholarly Greek, and then the New Testament was written in Koine, which was the common Greek spoken on the streets. But Greek has changed so much that I could not go, using my knowledge of Koine Greek, I could not go to Greece and expect to walk around and find my way and ask questions and be understood. A little sidelight, when I was in college, my first semester of Greek, it's amazing, there were 36 people in the class first semester. There were 23 second semester. By the third semester, we were down to 12. Fourth semester, we started out with 6, and by the end of the term, there were 3 of us left. They learned to get out. But what was really interesting, that first semester, there was a guy from Greece, and he was there to play. His family heritage was from Greece, and they spoke Greek at home and all this kind of stuff. And he was there to play football, actually. He was going to be a place kicker. And he thought, to fulfill his foreign language requirement for his four-year degree, he'd just go ahead and take Greek. He dropped out after 3 weeks, because he couldn't understand what was going on, because it was so different from what he spoke and what he was used to reading. And that was back in the 70s, so you can imagine what it's like now. Hippolytus also, historian, wrote that Matthew wrote, in fact, he said Matthew wrote the first gospel, and it was in Hebrew, later translated to Greek. However, there is no copy of a Hebrew gospel of Matthew in existence anywhere, and there is no evidence other than these three that there was ever a Hebrew copy of the gospel of Matthew. It's generally understood that Mark was the first gospel written, and kind of a template for Matthew and Luke. Now, most of the traditions about Matthew is that he lived to an old age and died of natural causes, one of the few that supposedly died of natural causes. But some of the traditions, you know, after a while, how would you like to be the only guy in your neighborhood? Everybody else is martyred, and then you die of natural causes, you know, kind of thing. Some later traditions state he was either killed by a sword or he was burned to death. Some of those traditions state he eventually went to Ethiopia and other lands and preached, and it was in Africa that he was actually martyred, either by sword or by fire. But those are legends. We don't know for sure how Matthew died. His symbol is three money bags because he was a tax collector. Three money bags typically is a symbol of Matthew. No, that was Zacchaeus. But he was a tax collector. Yeah, Zacchaeus. You missed it by that much. But as I said, see if y'all remember, a couple of years ago in my children's sermon, I told the children that Zacchaeus, though he was a wee little man, and none of them knew that song, although all of y'all did, but even though he was a small man, a wee little man, Zacchaeus was not the smallest man in the Bible. It was Nehemiah. Yeah, dum-dum-sh. Yeah, he invented the orange drink. And if you remember back to that day, I also said, by the way, folks, Mary listened to that when she got up at 3 o'clock in the morning to go to the bathroom, and I woke up and I said, you know, I've been thinking about the children's sermon tomorrow, and I'm going to tell them that Zacchaeus wasn't the smallest man, but it was Nehemiah. So, see, it doesn't stop even at 3 o'clock in the morning. Pray for her. No, but she did groan when she got back in bed. So Matthew, one of those, and one of very possibly one of those family members, once again. And it's kind of interesting. I wonder if indeed he was the brother of James the Less and Judas Thaddeus, what they thought about him and what they thought about Jesus calling him. Wonder if they were happy or don't know which was the older. Maybe he was the older brother that picked on everybody, don't know. Or maybe he was the baby. You know, the baby in the family always gets what they want, and they get the older ones in trouble. I speak as a firstborn. But I have wondered over sometimes what they thought about Matthew being brought into the fold, if they got along with him or not. Philip was one of Jesus' earliest followers, and he is mentioned only in the list of the disciples and in the Gospel of John. When there are lists of the disciples in the Gospels, you'll find Philip's name. When the disciples are listed in Acts chapter 1, you find Philip's name. But the only place you find anything about Philip other than his name is in the Gospel of John. He's different from Philip the evangelist in the book of Acts chapter 8, who had four daughters that preached or prophesied. Philip baptized the Ethiopian eunuch, according to some traditions. Others say, nope, he wasn't the one. That was Philip the evangelist. So, when we look He was probably a fisherman from Bethsaida. And when you look at various stories about him in the Gospel of John, he had a lot of knowledge or interest in the hope of Israel, the Messiah, and followed Jesus' call. He's the one who went to get Nathanael, also known as Bartholomew. It's Philip who went to Nathanael under the tree, Gospel of John, also known as Bartholomew, and said, come on, we've found him. We found the Messiah, and he's from Galilee. And, of course, Nathanael said, can anything good come from there? So he was bringing. He was bringing someone to Jesus. In the feeding of the multitudes, John chapter 6, he also was there and helped to bring the food and share the food with the multitudes. In John chapter 12, Gospel of John chapter 12, starting in verse 20. One page short here. Now among those who went up to worship at the festival were some Greeks. They came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida in Galilee, and said to him, Sir, we wish to see Jesus. And Philip went and told Andrew. Then Andrew and Philip went and told Jesus. So Philip was involved in bringing these Greeks. He and Andrew were both involved in bringing this group of Greek pilgrims who were interested, who had heard of Jesus, who had heard Jesus speak and were interested in meeting him. You know, kind of like the celebrity status. You know, can you get us back a backstage pass kind of thing and let us meet him? And in chapter 14, verse 8, he requested that Jesus show us the Father and we shall be satisfied. This is the section here in John 14. Familiar section. Don't let your hearts be troubled. If you believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house there are many dwelling places. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And if I go to prepare a place for you, I will come again and take you to myself, so that where I am, there you may be also. And you know the way to the place where we're going. Thomas said to him, Lord, we don't know the way. We don't know where you're going. How can we know the way? Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you know me, you will know my Father also. From now on, you do know him and have seen him. And Philip said, well then, Lord, show us the Father and we'll be satisfied. He was always wanting a little bit more, a little bit more. He was one of those who would raise questions, although a little bit at a time, a little bit of increment. Wanted to attain knowledge. Tradition states that he preached in Phrygia and was martyred at the city of Hierapolis by hanging, or that he was crucified upside down. Some of that tradition comes from Josephus and others. Some of that tradition comes from a Gnostic writing called the Acts of Philip. And I mention that because, and there were several with Peter's name on them. I mention that because the early churches didn't have one set group of scriptures. In fact, it's not until the mid-4th century when Athanasius, who was bishop at the time, wrote an Easter letter to the churches. And for the first time, only the 27 books we currently have in the New Testament were listed as the canon, the accepted scripture. He called them wellsprings from which we may drink. But before that time, there were all kinds of things that were read and used by different churches. There were numerous, a couple of dozen gospels. We ended up with 4 that the church determined really were valid and best represented the earliest deposit of faith and the earliest teachings and life of Jesus. There were all kinds of apocalypses and letters and other writings that appeared out there. I've got some volumes in my library with those things in them, and I've read and studied a number of them. The Acts of Philip says that he was hung upside down on a tree. Other tradition says that he was crucified on a cross that was upside down. even there, legend varies as to whether it was a cross that's an upside-down T or whether it was the X cross that sometimes was used by the Romans and he was crucified upside-down spread eagle. One tradition holds that he asked that his body be wrapped in papyrus instead of linen because he wasn't worthy to be treated as well as Jesus was, and Jesus was wrapped in a linen shroud. There's also a Gnostic gospel of Philip. It's associated with the Gnostic community that speaks a lot about mysteries and sacraments, and that Philip was very key in the sacraments in the church. And that you were immersed into the mysteries through baptism, and through that you gained immortality. You were anointed with oil before you were immersed. And the oil, along with a formula, then gave you immortality. As I said, these are Gnostic. They're apocryphal. They've been studied by many. And when the church finally started determining, because they decided you couldn't let each and every church determine what it was going to read and believe and still call itself a part of the Christian church, that they needed things that were closely related to the life and the teachings of Jesus and the earliest understandings of Jesus' life and his teachings. Some of these other things aren't written until 2nd, 3rd century. And yet, they have the names of some of these disciples on them as if they were supposedly written by those disciples. If so, if Philip wrote the Gospel of Philip in the 2nd century, he was very literally a ghostwriter, because he was long dead by the time it's written. But what would happen is they would write these things to try and bolster their own particular position, their own particular little niche at which they were looking. And so, as I said, the church determined, took it upon itself through councils, through debates, through studies. There were actually four criteria. We've mentioned these briefly before. I don't want to go into a lot of detail, but the four criteria were usage. The things that were used the most in general by churches were looked at. The second was a word called apostolicity. Was the writer either an apostle, a relative of an apostle, or a scribe of an apostle? And if it passed that, the third one was what I call historical reliability. Did it agree, did the document agree with the life and the teachings of the historical Jesus or the earliest church's understanding of the life and the teachings of Jesus? And if it passed that, there was a fourth criterion, which is called Catholicity with a small c. Catholic with a small c means universal or general. Catholic with a big C means Roman Catholic. Catholicity with a small c. Does the book, does the document agree with the message of Jesus and the church in general, or is it very narrow and sectarian, like the Gnostics? Only those who are immersed in the mysteries of Gnosticism could attain the secret knowledge that would allow them to determine or find out eventually that deep down inside they were a piece of God that got trapped in a human body, and that once they looked inside they would find God and God would be them. So all that new age stuff these days, it's just old age stuff repackaged. The symbol generally associated with Philip is a basket, because of his role in the feeding of the multitudes, the feeding of the crowds. And then we get to Simon Peter, and there's no way we can finish Simon Peter tonight, but we'll start Simon Peter tonight. Simon Peter. His name was either Simon or Simeon, his given name. Jesus gave him the name Petros, or Aramaic. More than likely, Petros is the Greek, which means rock or stone. So he was the rock. I don't think he was on WWE wrestling. But probably the name that Jesus used for him was Kephas or Cephas, which is Aramaic. Because remember, biblical Hebrew wasn't the common language in Palestine back then. It was Aramaic. And so Cephas also means rock or stone. He is the son of Jonah, Matthew 16. That's the Aramaic word for John, the Greek. In John chapter 1, he's called the son of John. But Jesus says, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, son of Jonah," in the Gospel of Matthew. His home was Bethsaida, according to the Gospel of John, or Capernaum, both of which were near the Sea of Galilee, according to Matthew, Mark, and Luke. He was a fisherman, obviously. And he is always listed first in lists of the disciples because he was considered so important. He's always listed first. He was the leader of that inner circle, that triumvirate. Peter, James, and John. He was very outspoken. He was often the spokesman for the group. It is Peter who tried one time to keep people from bringing children to Jesus. It is Peter who made that famous statement, "I say you're the Christ," when Jesus said, "Who do men say that I am? Now who do you say that I am?" It was Peter who said those words recorded for all posterity's sake at the transfiguration of Jesus, and he said, "You know, Lord, it's a good thing we're here. Just think, we would have missed all this if we hadn't been here. Let's build booths and stay up here." He says, "Good thing we're here. Let's make booths up here and we'll just stay up here. Never have to go back down and worry with the world." He was married. We know that. At least in part. How? Right. That's right, Jerry. The disciples, they went in Mark, went to the house of Simon Peter in chapter 1. And there, Peter's mother-in-law was sick, and so Jesus healed her, and she got up and fixed him something to eat and served him. So we know he was married. And if you look at 1 Corinthians chapter 9, I know I make a statement here, but I want to read it. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. One of these newer Bibles and pages won't stick together. Starting in verse 3. "This is my defense to those who would examine me." This is, of course, Paul writing. "Do we not have the right to our food and drink? Do we not have the right to be accompanied by a believing wife, as do the other apostles and the brothers of the Lord and Cephas?" That is Peter. "Or is it only Barnabas and I who have no rights to refrain from working for a living?" So we know that at least at some point in time, Simon Peter's wife traveled with him as well. Early on, both he and his brother Andrew probably were, although Andrew was a closer follower of John the Baptizer than Simon Peter, but they were probably followers of John the Baptist, John the Baptizer. We know that Andrew was, and there's good evidence that Simon Peter may have been. Interestingly enough, the word or the name for Peter, whether it's Petros or Cephas, far outshines the name Simon in the New Testament. In fact, Peter is used to refer to him 155 times in the New Testament. Many times more. Multiple times more than he's called Simon. It was a distinctive name, a name given that oftentimes said something about either a person's character or a person's expected role, to be a rock, to be a stone. People get nicknames. It's kind of like a nickname. People get nicknames. Some of them I haven't figured out that I've heard around here. I understood after a while why Furman was called Hoppy. Okay. I still don't know. Yeah, Shag. I still don't know why. Never been told why Lewis Cowart is known as Brudge. Couldn't say brother? Okay, now I know. He was called Brudge. Okay. And there are others. Yeah. Dink. Dink Higgins. Why is he called Dink? His name's what? His name's Denver, but he's called Dink. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, he was way before. He was way before Spaceballs the movie, where all the little guys were running around going dink, 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 dink. Yeah. So, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know why Milford's called Punchy. Okay, well, maybe. I thought maybe it's because he fought. punch people, yeah.
Why ask for somebody named in marriage? I'm kind of afraid of that.
I can understand if his nickname was Punchy. When you asked for Gloria's hand in marriage, you're probably standing at least out of arm's reach, right? Yeah, but it says something, okay? If indeed it was punching out hits, because he was a baseball player and a really good baseball player, you can understand that kind of thing. So, Peg Leg Bates, you can understand why he was called Peg Leg. But sometimes we just don't know. Promise you, and I still don't know why. Although I have some ideas, but I had a classmate. He was one of those 36 that started out in Greek, and by the time we got to the second semester, he was not among the 23. Although he was going into youth ministry. But Craig's nickname, I didn't even know his name was Craig for a long time, was Fungus. His name was Fungus. That's what everybody called him. He said throughout high school, he was called Fungus. When he arrived on campus, he introduced himself as Fungus. I don't know. We had a guy. I played football with a guy in high school that, and he was a good linebacker. He would hit you hard, but he couldn't. If you put the football right in front of his hands and told him and said, "I'm gonna let go of it," you grab it. He couldn't. We called him Stone Finger because it's like his fingers were made out of stone. He couldn't catch a football if you stood right here and tossed it underhand. He'd muff it. So, but Peter's name, the Rock, was not only something maybe of his character. He was strong-willed, had foot and mouth disease very often, opened his mouth to rearrange his feet. But he also became a pillar or a stone within the leadership of the church early on. Although it's kind of interesting, and we'll end with this and then we'll pick up here, a couple of things. It's kind of interesting that Mark... And John Mark is supposedly the one who... Maybe Peter was beating himself up, I don't know. John Mark is the one who supposedly was the scribe of Simon Peter, and the Gospel of Mark is the remembrances of Peter and the preaching of Peter. And yet, the Gospel of Mark is much more uncomplimentary when it describes Peter and incidents in which Peter's involved than Matthew. And we'll go into a little bit more of this next time, but... In the Synoptic Gospels, Mark, Matthew, and Luke, Peter has a much more prominent role, especially in the Gospel of Matthew. But in the Gospel of John, there's only one time that Peter is talked about between his call and the Last Supper. In fact, if all we have is the Gospel of John, we wouldn't know that Simon Peter had any kind of significant role at all in the church and in the early church and among the disciples. But we'll pick up there next time and talk some more about Simon Peter. Like I said, I still got these and that at the top of this page, just on Simon Peter. And then we'll move toward Simon the Zealot and then toward Didymus. the twin. But maybe we can come to a point where, from tonight or from our study as a whole, we can come to the point where we realize that, you know, Jesus didn't choose just the elite. Jesus chose people who knew how to work for a living. Jesus chose people who had zeal within their hearts for whatever they set their minds to. But he also chose people that would be open to learning and sharing the good news of God's grace. From a tax collector to fishermen. I think so. I think so, Wesley. That he chooses fishermen. He chooses a tax collector. He chooses zealots to show that at least one of them could change, Simon the Zealot. He chose all kinds of folks. He chose those who had terrible tempers. And eventually he chose, as an apostle after the fact, you're right, William, he chose Saul of Tarsus, also known as Paul, who was a religious zealot for Judaism and didn't mind having people arrested, tortured, and even killed. So there are all kinds of folks that God calls and God uses. But we see that throughout the entire Bible as we go. He prays in John chapter 17, high priestly prayer, that they may all be one just as you and I, Father, are one. And he does say, before you start pointing your finger at somebody else and chewing them out and complaining too much about them, you better look at yourself. Well, thank y'all, and it's 10:10. I hope you have a good night. God bless you. Go in peace and be careful. And I'll see you next week.